Hi, and welcome to the check-in for community connection and conversation live over the airwaves. I'm Janet Saidi. Thanks for checking in with us today. Okay, this is going to sound really obvious, but we can't be everywhere at once, right? None of us can see all the things all the time and be first-person witnesses to events everywhere. So then, how do we know what the President of the United States said yesterday or what happened at a protest downtown? We know because others, usually journalists, increasingly citizens, witness the events and record them. And this mediated filter is how we know about the world we're in. So how are you getting your information during these times? Who do you trust for this mediated filter of information? Tell us. You can call us for today's check-in, 882-4991. That's 573-882-4991. You can also tweet us at check-in underscore KBIA. We'll be back right after this. Hi, this is The Check-In. How we're all getting our information, our media consumption habits have become a critical factor in our democracy. Understanding the sources we get our news from and being able to analyze and judge the media that we're consuming is so important in this time that we're in. We know there's disinformation out there. It's actually become a weapon of sorts. We also know that all of us, no matter how savvy we are, prefer to hear viewpoints and frames for stories that we already agree with. All of this makes it really challenging for all of us to get on the same page and function and vote from the same set of facts and similar pictures, a shared picture about our shared world. Today, we're checking in with someone who really looks at all of this and researches it and is an expert in how we're getting our information and the quality of that information. It's Julie Smith. She's a professor of communications and journalism at Webster University. She's spent decades researching this stuff, teaching media literacy or how and where we get our information. Welcome to The Check-In, Julie Smith.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here, and this is indeed my favorite topic in the whole wide world.
Well, great. I'm so excited to hear what you have to say about this and kind of what you're observing right now. Let me just remind our listeners that you can also let us know, what are you reading, watching, and listening to these days that keeps you informed? As our producer Alicia Haywood put it in a great question, how do you know what you know? Chances are you're an NPR listener if you're checking in with us. Why? And what else helps you sort out the good information from the bad? Call us at 573-882-4991. That's 573-882-4991. And let us know how you're getting information or what challenges you find or what questions or comments you have for Professor Julie Smith. You can also tweet us at check-in underscore KBIA, at check-in underscore KBIA. We'll watch your tweets and we'll put them on the air if you tweet us a question or a comment. So Professor Julie Smith, first, let me just start with a general question for you, which might be a little impossible, but then we can kind of explore it further, because you've written and observed how we get our information for years. And now we're in historic times. And so you're watching as a pandemic, social movements for racial justice, and now a historic election are all unfolding. And all of it is raising questions about our democracy, its future. As you watch all of this unfold from a position of information and media research, what are your main takeaways?
I think that I get nervous sometimes because I see the huge influx of information that people are consuming, and there's no real surefire way to verify that what we are consuming is legitimate. Just as the story broke yesterday about the fake emails that Iran and Russia were sending supposedly from a Proud Boys email account, It's so difficult to verify what we're seeing and what we're reading, especially now that so much of our consumption of information comes from social media platforms where they're really not filled with journalists. There are people that have journalism training, right? We tend to share things that we really agree with. And I think that's where some of the problem stems from, is that when you mentioned how are we informed, I think sometimes we're even losing our definition of what it means to be informed. And that's the biggest hurdle of all.
Interesting. So we're losing our sense of what it means to be informed. And we want to talk about how that's changing. You took us right away somewhere, Professor Smith, to somewhere I wasn't even sure we'd get to in this conversation, but which is, you know, because it's in the news right now. And like you said yesterday, that they're actually other countries and other governments, foreign countries and actors using disinformation. So you have found yourself sitting in a place where it's become really crucial to the survival of our democracy in a way, this information, how we're getting our information on this topic.
Right. And, you know, democracy depends on an intelligent voter, right? Mm-hmm. And how do we define what that means? And in many cases, I think that we are so comfortable in the echo chambers where we live in our social media networks. We tend to congregate with people who think, feel, believe, and vote the way that we do, right? Mm-hmm. So we're so comfortable in those circles. And because of the way the algorithms of these social media platforms are set up, if we like pages that have many things in common, the mm-hmm. algorithm is going to continue to give us pages similar to those. So we end up further and further in this hole of information that's just affirming what we already think and feel rather than ever hearing an opposite viewpoint. And mm-hmm. when we get away from that, I think it gets harder and harder to imagine how anyone could possibly vote differently than we do.
Okay.
And I think that leads to the polarization of what we're seeing now.
Yeah, so you're bringing up so many interesting things here. The fact that we're all in an algorithm. So something to remind
yeah.
yourself of. And, you know, remind your friends of. You're in an algorithm. And so that's one thing to realize, I suppose, about how you're getting your media when you're in an algorithm when you're looking at it through social media. You're I guess you're also in an algorithm when you go to the newyorktimes.com or when you go to npr.org potentially.
Well, sure, because all of that, you know, we leave little breadcrumbs wherever we go mm-hmm. somewhere
yeah.
online.
Yeah.
And those breadcrumbs are very valuable to people because then they know what we like. So, for example, Instagram knows that I am a dog person mm-hmm. and not a cat person. So in one way, I don't, mm-hmm. you know, I typically don't see any ads that don't appeal to me. And that's a plus, right? But at the same time, I'm never hearing or seeing anything that I haven't already trained that algorithm that I want to see. And that's tough. That's a challenge.
Oh, that's funny. That's such a great example. I mean, so, you know, you could use that as an example with students. And I know you teach these things and we want to talk about that. But, you know, how you could go through life, Professor Julie Smith, thinking that you're in a dog world. There really are no cats.
Exactly. Exactly. And since I never see anything about cats, I can't even imagine how they exist.
They probably
right?
don't. You know, they might not. So. So that's a great example, actually, that you've just, you know, sort of provided us. And so we'll get into this a little bit more. Let me just remind listeners here for a second. We are talking with Professor Julie Smith, and we're talking about how we get our information and how do we know it's good? How do you know your information is good? How do you know what you know? Let us know. Just let us know what your media diet is. I'm curious about it. Julie Smith is probably curious about it. What do you read? Are you trusting social media for all these problems and all this information? Do you trust it anyway? Do you have workarounds? Or are you happy to just kind of talk with people that you agree with? I mean, it is easier. It is especially in the time we're in. So let us know your thoughts, questions, comments. You can call us at 573-882-4991. I give that a little too quickly. I think sometimes it's 573-882-4991. Give us a call. You can also tweet us at @checkin_KBIA. You can also text us 88474. We'll watch out for your text, 88474, to get your question or comment to Professor Julie Smith. Julie, next week is Media Literacy Week, and the importance of media literacy for all of these reasons. It's been growing, increase in fake news, the political polarization that's dividing us and has actually become, that polarization has become a weapon in a way. Could you give us, let's back up a little bit and get your definition of media literacy and why it's so important right now?
Oh, sure. Well, it's interesting because when I started studying media literacy, it was all about television because that was the world that we were in. It was the, you know, the early 90s. And that's what we call a low-choice environment. We didn't have a lot of choices if we wanted information. We had newscasts on television, and we had newspapers, and we had radio, but that was basically it. Now we're in a high-choice environment, which means we have thousands of sources from where we can choose our information. So it changes the experience, right? Mm. So some people might think that media literacy is anti-media or media bashing, and that couldn't be further from the truth. What we are doing is saying, You know what? The average American now is spending between 11 and 11 and a half hours a day with electronic mass media. We're not saying that that's a bad thing. We're saying, hey, if we're spending this much time with something, why aren't we talking about it more? Why aren't we talking about it in the schools? Why aren't we talking about it at the kitchen tables and in the carpool lines? And what it essentially boils down to is asking questions about the messages that we receive. Who's the sender? What's their motive or intent? How have they created the message to get my attention? How could someone else interpret this message differently than me? Who's the target audience? And my, you know, what information is left out? My favorite question to ask is, who's making money from this message? And once you start asking those questions, it's just critical thinking, Janet. That's that's really what it is. It's a critical thinking skill. So we don't tell people not to consume media, but we beg them not to consume it passively and be active in their consumption, so they are checking the sources and checking who's profiting and checking, most importantly, this time of year, how those messages are making them feel. Because if a message can elicit an emotional response from us, we're less likely to be rational when we're interacting with that message.
Okay.
And so that's the biggest piece of advice I would give people, is that if you come across a message that gives you a really strong emotional response, whether it's anger or sadness or joy, that is the first clue that you should probably check it for authenticity.
All right. That's great. So there are some what our producer is calling verification tools that
yes.
I think of as something journalists use, but you're saying citizens need this too, and it's just asking these questions. We want to talk about this a little bit more with you, Professor Julie Smith. Let me just throw out there, we've got a text from someone who's listening. Thanks for your text. They say, I get my information from KBIA and online through major news outlets. I spend a lot of time trying to convince people Facebook is unreliable and Twitter is often half true on breaking news. Any quick comment there, and then we have to go to a break.
Yes, I should invite that person to speak to my class, because it's absolutely true.
Okay, thanks for the text. And those of you listening, you can text us 88474. Text check-in. It's got a dash in it. Text check-in with your comment, and it'll get to us at 88474. We will be right back. We're talking about good information and how to get it and how to know when it's not good information with Professor Julie Smith. We will be right back here on The Check-In after this. Welcome back to The Check-In. I'm Janet Saidi. With Election Day coming up, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the sheer amount of political media. You're seeing it on your Facebook feed, in your Twitter feed, on TikTok for you. Pages all flooded with messages meant to inform, persuade, excite, incense. Maybe all of those, maybe just one of those. Here to help us navigate these murky waters is our guest, Webster University professor and media literacy expert, Julie Smith. We're talking about how we get good information and how we know it's good. You can join us. We want to know, how are you getting your news? Is it from Facebook or Twitter? Are you avoiding that consciously, and why? What's your media diet? Just let us know what's on it. You can call us at 573-882-4991. That's 573-882-4991. Tweet us at check-in underscore KBIA. And we got a text in the last segment. Thanks for that. You can also text us your question or comment, 88474. Just text check-in. It's got a dash in it, to 88474. So, Professor Julie Smith, you mentioned something. We all like to see things that we already agree with us, especially when things are kind of difficult. It's really, really comforting to be around like minds. And what that is also called by people like you and researchers and experts is confirmation bias. We all suffer from confirmation bias, but that's just the bias of just wanting to hear and wanting to read and learn about what we already know and hear viewpoints that we already share. How do we guard against this? How do we keep ourselves open to learning?
Question, right? I think the first thing to do is to acknowledge the biases and baggage that we bring to the communication experience, mm-hmm. and recognize that the sources that we choose might reflect what we already want to hear. And we also need to be careful too, and be aware of when we are presented with facts that might cause us some cognitive dissonance or mental discomfort, mm-hmm. to not necessarily shut them down right away, but use them as a way to possibly learn something different. That's, I think, the hardest thing to convince people to do is to widen their media diet, mm-hmm. because that confirmation bias that you said we suffer from, I would almost say that we enjoy it, right?
Yes.
Because it is so comfortable.
Definitely.
So we want, just like we're encouraged to have a wide range of diet in the foods that we eat, mm-hmm. I would encourage the same with our media consumption and just try to mix it up. Recognize, and what we call here, what we call this is called lateral reading. Mm-hmm. So if, for example, if I see something on Facebook, I did see something on Facebook in March that Queen Elizabeth had tested positive for COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Well, I see this on Facebook and I'm thinking, okay, if this was real, why is this one person the only one talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're doing lateral reading, once you see something that seems a little fishy, mm-hmm. check out many other sources. And if no one else is talking about it, that's a red flag that it's probably not happening. So you want to reach out to a wide range of sources and see if that same story is coming up.
Okay.
And even if it's the same story, right, it's going to be presented in many different ways, depending on who the source is. And we have to be aware of that, too, right?
Yeah, that's so true. But that's a good habit to get into, is just double-checking, verifying things that you hear first before you react. Julie Smith, you're reminding me that I read somewhere, which actually helped me in my sort of helping against confirmation bias, was that I read that it's actually painful to confront viewpoints that you don't share. As a journalist, I kind of feel like my political opinions are journalism with a capital J, and my political party is journalism with a capital J. So you're sort of trained, but we still find it really difficult to be confronted with something that goes against what we thought was going on. When I heard the word pain associated with that, it actually helped me to realize what's going on, that there is something psychological going on when you expand those viewpoints and expand those sources.
There is. And there's even something called the familiarity backfire effect, that when we are confronted with conflicting information, we tend to double down. You know, we dig in rather than exploring that other piece of information. We dig in and kind of die on that hill, so to speak. And that can be painful too, right? Because we end up, and there's all these stories about how, you know, families can't even have dinner together anymore because of the political environment. And I think a lot of that relates to our media diet and how sheltered they can be.
So, Julie Smith, first of all, you're giving us some great phrases to throw at people at Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, just try that familiarity backfire effect, Uncle Jim. You know, that's what's going on there. Or confirmation bias. So here you have it in the check-in, listeners. Some great phrases to take with you into Thanksgiving dinner, which might not look the same this year, as we know. But Julie Smith, tell us how can someone change these media habits? Tell us a little bit more about how you mentioned one example that you do. How can people who are looking to, okay, I get it, I need to have a wide variety. How do I do this? How do I change my diet?
I think you want to do it gradually, right? And you want to, I want to back up a little bit and talk about bias. Mm-hmm. Because usually when I do workshops along these lines, someone always, their first complaint about the news is, it's so biased.
Oh, yeah.
And my response is always, well, sure it is. It's a business, right? So if I have a cable news channel and I have data that 90% of my viewers are dog people, I'm going to run pro-dog stories all day, and I'm going to run anti-cat stories because I'm feeding my audience what they want. Because my goal, right, is to keep them from changing the channel. Because the longer they stay on, the more I can charge for the commercial. And that's really what it's all about, right? News, I'm using air quotes, news, of course not NPR, but it's not a public service, right? It's, it's a business. So we want to be aware that most stories created by humans have some sort of angle to them, right? Just because we are human beings. And we want to be aware of that. So I wouldn't say it matters so much where you get your news as long as you know where your news is coming from. And once, at least what I've discovered in the classroom, is that once that students recognize the role they play in the economic structure of it all, it changes their relationship with it. Because if we are consuming a website or an app for free, we are not the customer. We are the product being sold to the advertisers. So the name of the game is to keep us on the website. It's to get us to click that headline. It's to get us to keep from changing the channel. That's the goal. And so they're going to give us what we want so that we stay on that source. So you want to be aware of how they are, I don't want to say training you, but how they are feeding you in a way that keeps you on that particular source. And so just try different ones is what I would recommend.
Okay. Julie, we have a question from one of our producers. How do you encourage someone else to change their media diet? It's so interesting. He's saying, you know, Chris Husted, like, consider your aunt at Thanksgiving or a relative. Like, and you see someone's just got really bad media habits and they don't realize it. What can you say to them?
That's a tough question, right? Because sometimes I get asked, I see somebody posting fake things on Facebook, should I call them out? And it's kind of the same question, right?
Yes, it is.
You want to be as gentle as possible and say, you know what, that's really interesting. Where did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't really remember, or if it doesn't come from a source, or you could say, was that story found in any other sources? Did any other outlet talk about that story? You want to gently kind of ask them those questions so that they come to the realization themselves. You don't want to say, look, you know, you got to mix it up over there, honey. you want them to gradually come to that conclusion on their own, because then it will stick better. It doesn't always work. I can tell from experience that doesn't always work, but it's worth a try.
Okay, that's really good advice, and we should really build this entire conversation as how to prepare for Thanksgiving dinner. But it's really, there's something before Thanksgiving dinner arrives. There is something even more important, which is the election on November 3rd. So it's like we need to arm ourselves for that as well. So let me just remind people, you know, let us know. Have you encountered this? You probably have seen misinformation, disinformation on Facebook. If you're here in the check-in, you're probably... we're guessing you probably have a decent media diet. You're probably listening to NPR. You probably feel like you're getting some good information. How do you handle disinformation when it confronts you? You know, the queen has coronavirus, for instance. How do you check? How do you verify? What do you say to people? What do you say to people on Facebook? Have you found a good way? Have you done it the wrong way? Let us know your experience with this. You can join us. As usual, call us at 573-882-4991. That's 573-882-4991, or you can tweet us or text us your question or comment or experience. It's at @check_in_KBIA, or you can text us at 88474, text check-in with a dash in it to 88474. Professor Julie Smith, you brought up journalism. Let me ask a little bit about how the media is doing its job. You mentioned that the media has been part of the problem. So this is just something that we in the media have to be the first to recognize, that there are reasons people don't trust the media. It's not incredibly surprising that people don't trust the media. And when we say the media, we're talking about an awful lot. We're talking about news, we're talking about network news, and we're talking about algorithms that are used. Where does this intersect with journalism and how journalism does its job?
Well, we're in a very strange time because I would say that most people are consuming quote-unquote news now that is not actually produced by people who have had journalism training.
Okay.
So that's one way to distinguish, I think, valid information from invalid information. But mm-hmm. that being said, journalists make mistakes too, right? So we have to distinguish between misinformation, which is accidental, mm-hmm. and disinformation, which is created with intent to mm-hmm. fool. Okay.
Yeah.
And a lot of the disinformation, like we learned in the news yesterday, can come from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand the motive. So in many cases, the motive, like with Iran and Russia, is to sow confusion and reduce our confidence in the democratic process, right?
Yes, chaos.
Chaos is a word
that's coming up a lot.
Chaos, yeah.
Yes.
And some of these, especially like most of the quote-unquote fake news that came over in 2016 was from a tiny little village in Macedonia,
yeah.
where these young men were creating these pages with yeah. great clickbait headlines, right? You want to watch out for headlines that are in all caps, headlines with lots of exclamation points, headlines that say, mm-hmm. the media won't tell you this, right? Because mm-hmm. NPR is never going to say, retweet this.
Right? Okay.
Right?
That's
yeah.
a really good point. Yeah.
So those are your clues. You want to look for those. Mm-hmm. And they're making money from that. So there's lots of motivation for disinformation to be throwing around the way it is. But you mentioned something that the trust in the traditional or legacy media is at an all-time low right now. So there's this vacuum of disinformation that can fill that void. And if they're telling us messages that we really like, well, then we're more likely to believe them. Because research tells us if we come across a message that we don't like or that we do like, we're less likely to check it for authenticity. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we have to be really careful of. I've been told that it's always good to pay for news, you know, pay for news that's behind a paywall, because then they're not necessarily trying to get you to not click to another site. But it's really just awareness of who the sender is and what's their motive or intent and what are they doing to try to get my attention. Something else that we need to be really aware of is how easy it is for anybody to create something that looks legitimate. Mm-hmm. So years ago, right, if something was on a screen, it was produced by a network, and it had been vetted, and there were editors. And now we can create you and I can create something on our phones that looks like it's from CNN.
Yeah.
So there's that visual aspect, too, because we are so, it's so much quicker for us to process images than words. So if we see a meme or even a news photo that maybe has been repackaged or reframed or recycled in a certain way, we're going to believe that. And that's something, another thing we really need to be aware of is that it's very easy for anyone to create something that looks legitimate, and it's so easy to take a legitimate photo from 10 years ago and spin it or repackage it for whatever might be happening today.
Yeah,
there's so many things happening now that we really have to be on our guard.
That's a really interesting point. And those of us in journalism will remember that when social media started happening and citizen journalism started happening, I think a lot of journalists really thought that was very exciting. Like, here's a way to actually incorporate citizen journalism into what we do. We're going to have eyes and ears on the ground everywhere. But what has actually happened with the world of disinformation that we're in and people harnessing this for with bad intentions from inside the country and in campaigns and outside the country is that journalists have had to set up entire verification units, right? So
right.
That has actually increased the need for legitimate journalism, right? Even for those of us who were kind of feeling generous, I think, about, you know, public citizen journalism are now thinking, oh, yeah, you can't trust anything, because it is very, very difficult. We teach this a little bit in our journalism classes here at the University of Missouri. How do you verify a photo? How do you verify a video? I actually don't feel that I, as a journalist, am equipped to do it. I feel like I need people who are really good at this stuff to do it.
You know what, though, Janet? It is actually very, very very easy. There
really?
Are loads. Oh, it, I promise that it is. There are loads of tools that are free and very accessible. If you're a Chrome user, you can absolutely just right click on a photo, and you'll get a drop down menu that says search Google for this image, And it will tell you every other website that's using that image.
Okay.
And there are websites where you can enter in email addresses, and they'll tell you if the email address is valid. So the thing is that the tools are there. People might not know that they exist. But even if they do know they exist, it still takes time and effort, right? Because I feel, and this might not be a very popular opinion, but I feel like it is our responsibility to sift through this information glut that we're in to figure out what's real, meaningful, valid, and true. I don't trust Mark Zuckerberg to do it. I don't trust the government to do it. I feel like that it's up to us, right? And it takes time and effort. So that the tools are there. There's loads of websites that help people figure out what's real and what's not.
Okay.
But it just takes time and effort. And that's where the biggest challenge is.
All right. Well, you've just given us a little bit more to dive into. I'm so glad you're coming back with us after the break here. We are talking about good information, how to get it, how to know it's good. Turns out, Professor Julie Smith, you heard it from her. We have the tools to do it. We can right click on an image and find out where else that image has been. I like that. We're going to keep going with this conversation. Let us know how you get good information. How do you know it's good? What are you incorporating into your media diet? You can let us know at 573-882-4991, and we'll take your call in this next segment. We've just got a few more minutes with Professor Julie Smith, but we will be right back here on The Check-In after this. You're in The Check-In. I'm Janet Saidi. Our topic today is good information. How do you get it? Where do you look for it? And who do you trust to stay informed? How do you know what you know? Is NPR part of your NPR diet? What about social media? Do you trust Facebook, Twitter? Are you aware of the algorithms? Are you breaking out of them somehow? Do you find it hard to get good information? Let us know. You can join our conversation today at 882-4991, 573-882-4991. We're talking with Professor Julie Smith. She researches media literacy, which is all about how we get information. And it's important, more important than ever right now in the run-up to what many people are calling the election of our lifetime. Information has always been about, and the media, honestly, journalism has always been about informing citizens for a democracy, informing citizens to vote. So this is a really good time for us to have this conversation. How are you getting the information that you need to vote in here in Missouri? Let us know, 573-882-4991. You can call us with your question or comment. Let me see. We've got a call, Professor Julie Smith. I want to unpack a little bit more of what you were talking about with journalism and what journalism can do and how media can be part of the problem and part of the solution. But we have a caller. Julie is joining us. Julie, thanks for joining us in the check-in. Did you have a question or comment for us today?
I'll be brief. I just have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I feel I'm prepared for Thanksgiving, so thank you.
Okay. Glad to help.
No worries. One thing I do is I have not defriended a lot of people, so I do kind of watch both lines. And if I see something that I'm a little concerned about, either on either extreme, I'll go to Snopes and check there. And that's usually pretty helpful for me. And maybe I'm saying it wrong, S-N-O-P-E-S.
No, and that's right.
Okay. And the other thing I just wanted to hear your take on, the president the other day was called out on something and the interviewer said, "You said," and he said, "That was a retweet." I just think we all need to take responsibility for our retweets. You know, I and somehow validating it if I retweet it, you know, so I have to be aware of that as an individual. Lastly, and I'm done, is it's all of our responsibility. If a little small village in Macedonia can affect this, I can affect this, and it's all of our responsibility. So thank you, ladies. I'm ready for Thanksgiving.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that. Julie, if you have a moment, you can stay on the line. I'd love to get Professor Smith's, well, I think Julie has left us, but Professor Smith, Julie brings up some great points there. Snopes, what she's going to verify, the
right.
importance of being careful about what you retweet. You might be retweeting the Internet Research Group in a little town in Macedonia.
And you know what's
rather
so
than
interesting,
what you think you're retweeting. Yes.
Right. And so many people on their Twitter profiles will say retweets do not equal endorsements. But I think that when we see something on our Twitter timeline, we just take it as an endorsement, even if the profile might say that it doesn't necessarily mean an endorsement. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think when we see it, we just assume, oh, that person thought enough of this message to send it to all of their followers. So in a way, it is an endorsement. So I'm totally with you there, Julie. Also, I would do, as I mentioned earlier, lateral reading. I would also do lateral checking. Mm-hmm. And here's why. Snopes, of course, is the granddaddy of them all. It gets about 300,000 hits a day.
Can you explain what Snopes is?
Yeah. So if you see something that's gone viral and, you know, you activate your spidey sense, you're not quite sure if it's legit or not, you can go to Snopes.com, and they have a repository of viral stories that they have either verified or debunked, or they say this is part true, part false. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting place to start. But there are other websites. Hoax Slayer is another. Emergent is another. I would encourage lateral checking just to make sure that all these fact-checking sites are coming up with the same result.
Okay. That's great. Julie, we're in a journalism town here in Columbia with the home of the Missouri School of Journalism. Can you give us more insights into how you think journalism can do a better job of raising information literacy in our journalism? Journalism can be part of the problem and part of the solution. What are some good examples, and what would you like to see us doing as journalists?
Well, my background is actually public relations, and so I would say that journalism needs better PR because people who have real journalism training need to flaunt that and talk about the education that they have, and talk about the stories that they've done, and talk about where they've been published, who their editors have been, who they've learned from, because what we're really searching for, and I think at the heart of all this, what we're searching for is credibility. We want something to believe in. We want that. And I think that we're all hungry for that, and we don't know where to get it. So I would encourage journalism students, especially there at Mizzou, to say, you know what, be proud of what you do. Be absolutely proud of what you do, and make sure people know that you have training in this. And if you come across something that's false or fishy, I think it's journalism's job to teach us how they verified it or how they debunked it. Because it's interesting, there was an article, I think it was in Mental Floss a couple months ago. The idea was that when news outlets talk about viral stories that are fake, they actually give that story more oxygen and more exposure. And so there's debates, right, whether or not a news outlet should talk about something fake that went viral online. I feel like you acknowledge that there's been false information. Here are some tools to use to figure out if it's real, so that the news outlet or the journalist isn't saying that's fake. They're saying, let me show you how you can do your own investigation here. I think that's one solution, because I journalists need to be proud. We need them more than ever.
That's really exciting. Yeah, that's a great idea. Professor Smith, we have a question from Twitter. What is the role of social media companies and governments in addressing mis- and disinformation? So we are seeing companies flag and block posts and politicians getting upset about that. And we're hearing a lot of cries of free speech. Where do these freedom of speech and disinformation intersect? And what should we know about that?
Well, as far as freedom of speech and the First Amendment, it gets sticky, right, because so much information comes from outside of the United States. But what we need to recognize, these platforms are essentially privately held platforms, right? They can, and when we agree to the terms of service that nobody ever reads, when we agree to those terms of service, we tell them they can block our account and delete our account anytime they want. So we don't necessarily have that freedom of expression without consequences, like many people might think that they do. But at the same time, these platforms are businesses, and if the government tells these platforms what they can and cannot communicate, then that is a violation of the First Amendment. So it is a hot mess, Janet, and I'm fascinated to see how this is going to play out, because Twitter, I guess it was last week or the week before, when they blocked that New York Post story about Hunter Biden, they really opened up a can of worms, because now politicians are going to come after them for what they consider to be censorship. And Twitter can say, you know what, in these terms of service that you agreed to, you said we could do this. And so that brings up something that I talk about with my students a lot. Everybody agrees to the terms of service when we get on these platforms. No one ever reads them. And I think that that's something that we should really encourage people to do.
Interesting. Julie, you mentioned mental flaws in the magazine, which raised my curiosity. And this is a really important question for you. What do you use for information? How do you get your information? What's your favorite thing to read on a Sunday? And obviously you're reading an awful lot, but can you just give us a little sense of what we'd find and what your recommendations would be?
Yeah. And it might be kind of surprising. I try to read both ends of the spectrum. So I subscribe to National Review. I subscribe to The Atlantic. I read them both. I don't necessarily agree with everything I read in both, but I read both. Okay. I have a list on Twitter of verified news outlets. So I can go to that list and get kind of the gist of a story rather than sitting through my Twitter timeline. So in my list of news outlets that I trust, I have NPR, Associated Press, Reuters, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox, Washington Post, New York Times, you know, the biggies, right? Mm-hmm. And by looking at the sum of the whole of how all of these outlets are reporting the same story, I feel like I can get a good sense of where the story really is. Because obviously Fox is going to present it from one point of view, MSNBC is going to present the story from a different point of view, and the truth is always somewhere in the middle, right? And so that is what I trust, is the list that I have curated myself on Twitter. And then, of course, the standard, the big newspapers. But I rarely, rarely, rarely watch cable news unless I'm forced to by sitting in a waiting room somewhere.
Okay, that's good to know. Let me just give a shout out to our listeners. We've just got a few more minutes with Professor Julie Smith. We're talking about our media diet. It should be varied for a healthy diet and for you to know what's going on in your world. Who do you trust? You can let us know. Professor Julie Smith is talking with us about where we get good information. How do you know what you know? Give us a call at 573-882-4991. We just heard what's on Professor Smith's radar, what she's listening to and reading and watching. What are you listening to and reading and watching to prepare for November 3rd as a voter and just to know what's going on in your world? Let us know, 573-882-4991. We've also had a couple of tweets. You can tweet us at @checkin_KBIA, or you can text us at 88474, text checkin with a dash in it to 88474. We can take your question or comment any of those ways. Professor Smith, let me just ask a couple more questions about journalism, because I loved your idea that you gave us. Like, and I think a big thing is the trust. You said journalism and the media really needs PR, better PR. I think that's true. What can journalism do to win back trust?
Oh, that's a toughie. I don't know. I know that's not the answer that you wanted, Janet. I'm sorry. I don't know. I think it's going to take some time. We're living in a world where people are much more interested in what they believe than what is actually true.
Mm.
And journalism functions with truth, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a chasm there that's going to need to be filled or crossed one way or the other. And journalists are in a very difficult position because their outlets need to make money, right? Mm-hmm. And they make those outlets make money by the clicks or by the views or by the newspaper sold. And so you have to make sure that you're maintaining your audience, but while also possibly telling them things that they don't want to hear. And it's never been more important to be a journalist, but I also think it's never been more difficult because you are competing with Aunt Jewel on Facebook every single day.
Okay, and, that's you know, tough and, competition.
Yeah. Well, right. And there's so much noise. You know, we refer to it as information glut, right? There's just so much noise in our media world, in our high-choice, hyper-mediated world, that it's difficult for trustworthy voices to be heard because there's a lot of screaming on either end, and it's hard for really rational, grown-up voices to be heard in today's media environment. They're not rewarded.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, that kind of polarization and the divisiveness that you're describing is also has become a method from the disinformation campaigns and from foreign governments. When you talk about the disinformation, you are reminding me that their goal is the chaos, but their goal also is to pit us against each other. So that seems like another sign that people can follow. You mentioned retweets, like retweet this is one clue that this might not be a good, solid news source. But also, it's not necessarily a good, solid news source if they are making you feel angry about someone or something that is kind of going to pit you against other Americans. That's something that we just need to guard against, I think.
You bring up such an interesting point because that awareness that you mentioned is the reason that, you know, a few years ago, so many people thought that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizza parlor in Brooklyn, right?
Yes.
And that so many people thought it was completely legitimate that two Trump supporters would pour bleach on a black man and put a noose around his neck in downtown Chicago.
Yeah.
It's the Jussie Smollett story. So it's so easy now to believe the worst of someone who votes differently than us because we never hear the same messages that they hear. And we can't even relate to them anymore. And that's a problem.
I want to sneak in a question here from Alejandro. He called and was trying to get through, but we weren't able to get him through right away. But he does. I will put Alejandro's question to you, which is about Fox News. Can you trust Fox News? Is his question.
I would say that I trust Fox as much as I trust anybody else, but I understand their business model. So it all goes back to the cat and dog, right? If Fox has data that 90% of their viewers vote conservatively, they are going to feed those 90% with messages that confirm and make those viewers happy. Just like if MSNBC has data that 90% of their viewers vote liberally, then they're going to feed them liberal stories. The role of the networks is never to change anybody's mind. The role of the networks is to feed their audience what they want. If objective news made money, we would have it.
Mm. Yeah.
So if we're going to pick on Fox, we got to pick on everybody.
Okay.
If objective news made money, we would have it.
Great point. Julie, before we leave, and we've just got a minute left, so this is because we could do an entire show on just this, but I know that this starts with schools. I mean, when you're talking about how does journalism win back trust, maybe part of that answer is in what you're doing, which is promoting literacy education and media literacy education in schools at that level so that they learn, like, here's how journalism and information fits into our democracy. Seems like a really important thing. How is that going? How is media literacy in the schools and that effort going in 60 seconds?
Well, I am so happy that you brought that up because State Representative Jim Murphy actually presented a bill in Jefferson City in December proposing that the state create a panel of experts to study the media use of K-12 students in Missouri and how we can help them be better media consumers. The bill never got to a vote because, you know, the world kind of stopped spinning regularly in March. But if he's reelected, he's going to resubmit that bill and hopefully just get media literacy and information literacy awareness to the general public of Missouri in a way that it wasn't aware before.
All right. Julie Smith, we are just about out of time. I just want to say thanks so much for joining us on the check-in, and we'd love to continue the conversation. And I want to just throw out a reminder to our listeners as well that Media Literacy Week is next week, right in time, just before November 3rd, and you're voting. MediaLiteracyWeek.us is a good resource for this. Professor Smith, thanks so much, and good luck with all you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure having you. Let me just remind our listeners of something else. We would like to hear from you about next week's show. Next Thursday, right at this time at noon, we'll be talking about the ballot, what's on it, what decisions are you making, and we'll help you prepare by breaking down the issues, the candidates. And we have a voicemail. If you want to let us know how you're preparing to vote, what are the issues that are going to get you out to vote? Maybe you've already voted. Let us know, 833-560-1329. That's 833-560-1329. Leave us a message and let us know your thoughts for next week's show. The Check-In is produced by Alicia Haywood and me, with student producers Jane Mather Glass, Hannah France, Olivia Moses, Isabella Paxton, Alex Stutson, and Verano Moheski. Also, we have KBIA producer Christopher Husted, engineer Mark Johnson, and program director Kyle Felling directing today's show. We'll be back next Thursday, same time and same place. You can also podcast this and other episodes, podcast it at the check-in at kbia.org. I'm Janet Saidi. See you next Thursday.